Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, May 19, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we discuss the executive order concerning the promulgation and revocation of regulations, the one-in, two-out executive order. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome a new guest to Teleforum today. He's Thomas Johnson. He's the Deputy Solicitor General from the great state of West Virginia. He's going to give us some opening remarks of about 10 to 15 minutes, but then, as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions. With that, Tom Johnson, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean, and thank you for having me today. I'm here to talk about the President's Order on Reducing Regulation and Controlling Regulatory Costs, also known as the One-In, Two-Out Executive Order. And I'm here to talk to you about this because we in the Solicitor General's Office in the state of West Virginia are co-leading with the state of Wisconsin an amicus brief on behalf of 14 states total in support of the legality of the president's executive order in a pending legal challenge to the order in federal district court in D.C. And I'll get to that in a moment, but first I'd like to give you an overview of what it is that the president's executive order does. The basic principle is very simple. Whenever an executive department or agency proposes a new rule, the agency shall, in the notice of proposed rulemaking, identify two existing rules to be repealed. Now, for fiscal year 2017, which is currently in progress, the order specifies that the incremental cost of all new rules, which includes the cost savings for the rules identified to be repealed, shall be $0. And then for fiscal years 2018 and beyond, the order instructs that the director of the Office of Management and Budget within the White House shall identify to agencies, each agency, a total amount of incremental costs that will be allowed for that fiscal year. The agencies, in turn, will then have to annually provide an approximation of the total costs or savings associated with each new rule and repealed rules. And so the cost, the incremental cost of the new rule, and then the cost savings of the repealed rules. So the order on its face has several limitations. It does not apply when the repeals would not be permitted by law. It doesn't apply when the rule relates to certain national security functions or when the director of OMB provides an exemption. Now, after the executive order was issued, OMB issued first an interim guidance document, then a final guidance document that provided some additional important caveats concerning the application of the executive order. First of all, it made clear that the order doesn't apply to the independent agencies. It only applies to those agencies and departments directly under the president's control. The order only applies to what are called significant regulatory actions and significant guidance documents, which are defined as actions with an annual effect on the economy of $100 million or more. And the order does not apply, importantly, to rulemakings that would be required by statute or judicial order. In other words, oftentimes Congress will specify that an agency must enact a rule on a particular topic. This order would only be applicable in those cases in which the agency had broad discretion to choose to regulate or not to regulate, and in the course of that, the agencies and departments would need to take into account, as part of exercising that discretion, whether or not they could identify two additional rules for repeal that would achieve the cost savings identified by OMB. So that is basically how the order and the guidance work. Shortly after the order and actually the interim guidance came out, before even the final guidance was available, a number of groups filed a complaint in federal district court in Washington, D.C. to challenge, essentially mount a facial challenge to both the executive order and the guidance documents. They've since amended their complaint to take into account the final guidance, but essentially the claims and theories are the same. The plaintiffs in the case include the Natural Resources Defense Council, Public Citizen, and the Communications Workers of America, and they sued both the president and the heads of all of the relevant departments and agencies. And essentially, the complaint, or the reason why these organizations claim that they have standing, is because they believe that they are going to be impacted by the repealed rules in a variety of different contexts, which they spell out the complaint, and that essentially these rules, which are performing in their view important public policy functions, will be repealed for reasons that they believe are unlawful. So the judge in the case is Randolph Moss, who's an Obama appointee. And with respect to the particular legal claims raised by the plaintiffs, there are three principal claims. First is they claim that the order and guidance violate the separation of powers. What they claim is that the president is essentially unilaterally amending statutes that require that rules be enacted pursuant only to those factors that are written into the text of the statute itself. And so, for example, if you take a statute like the Exchange Act, and this is just one example, that requires that fees for certain market products be fair and reasonable, they would say, well, that's the statutory standard, and that is the only thing that the agency would have to take into account in promulgating rules. You can't superimpose, essentially, on the statute a requirement that the agency go forth and identify other rules to repeal in essentially the same rulemaking. There was among the parade of horribles that are listed in the complaint is the idea that, well, you might even have an agency that is offsetting a rule in one particular statutory context with rules from some completely different statutory context, completely unrelated context. So you'd be making trade-offs between, let's say, mine safety and more mine safety, less environmental protection. And they claim that that is not a permissible way of engaging in rulemaking. And in fact, the final guidance document does address that particular concern and note that there would have to be that essentially the rules ought to be as closely related as possible, and that you would need to have special permission in order to sort of do a cross-agency approach to fulfilling the requirements of the order. So we have separation of powers as the first claim. The second is that the order and guidance supposedly violate the president's duties under the Take Care Clause, that he is not taking care that the laws be faithfully executed, if he's essentially putting this sort of brake on the regulatory process by forcing agencies to consider this one in, two out requirement. And then the third claim is that it violates the APA, essentially the Administrative Procedure Act, essentially that it's arbitrary and capricious. And as I read the complaint, I mean, there are a number of reasons why they claim that just the very notion of this sort of bright line rule of having one new rule being offset by two rules to be identified to be repealed, that is just completely arbitrary and unmoored to any sort of the statutory goals and purposes of each of these various enabling statutes. And also, hearkening back to what I said before, that it essentially requires agencies to engage in sort of arbitrary trade-offs, things that are incommensurable, like mine safety and the environment. Well, how do you measure one against the other and determine that one is in the public interest and that you really don't need the others? And so that's sort of the crux of their APA claim. Now, the United States has moved to dismiss the complaint, and primarily on the grounds that the claims are premature, although they do get into the merits a little bit. The motion to dismiss is focused on the notion that the claims are not ripe because the order has not yet been implemented. It actually hasn't been carried out with respect to any particular rulemaking, and therefore there's no allegations and there can be no evidence that any of the named plaintiffs at this point are actually aggrieved by the order, and that there certainly must be lawful applications of the order. It certainly must be cases in which an agency can decide at the same time that they're going to enact one new rule and take two others off the books. And so we should wait for particular applications, and those can then be decided. The legality of the order and the guidance can then be decided on sort of a case case-by-case basis. So about a week after the United States filed its motion, we filed an amicus brief, again on behalf of 14 states, us co-leading with Wisconsin. And our interest in this case stemmed from the fact that over the past 8 years, there has been an enormous glut and growth in the number of rules enacted and the growth of the administrative state. A lot of those rules have had negative impacts on the states, in some cases unlawfully coerced the states to comply with or to accede to federal policy. In West Virginia in particular, we've been burdened significantly by a number of rules enacted by the Environmental Protection Agency over the past 8 years that we have challenged in court and successfully challenged in court. And so the sort of pro-regulatory direction of the past 8 years had a specific and deleterious impact on the states, in that the change in policy and the specific policy embodied in this new executive order was sort of a reasonable means or reasonable first step to scale that back, or to at least have agencies consider the costs of their actions holistically before imposing new regulatory burdens on the states and on their citizens. And the way we approached the brief, we wanted obviously to say something that was different from what the motion to dismiss said. And so we took our cues from the fact that the complaint raised a separation of powers challenge and the take care challenge, and both of them essentially went to the question of what is the president's power in this area. And so what we did was we took an historical approach, and we argued that both as a matter of constitutional interpretation and as a matter of history, at least with respect to the growth of the modern administrative state, that the executive order was both consistent with the Constitution and with the president's powers as the chief executive of the government, as well as with the approach to rulemaking and prior executive orders that have been adopted by presidents of both parties since the New Deal. And so starting first with a little bit of the constitutional theory, the theory essentially is one of a unitary executive, that ultimately the president has the final say on setting a policy direction for the executive branch, including setting national economic policy for the country, and that extends at least to all of the departments and agencies under his control. And this is sort of an easier question because this particular order and guidance excludes the independent agencies. And so it's essentially a component of the sort of the undisputed power of the president to remove the heads of departments and agencies at will. If he has that power to remove his subordinates at will, he certainly has the power to set policy for the departments, and that's been recognized by the DC Circuit in a case called Sierra Club, which was helpful for us to use in our brief. And in fact, it would be impossible for the president to coordinate and to set national policy unless there was some mechanism for him to exercise cross-agency control rather than having each agency be sort of an isolated island and doing its own thing. And this is where it helps that we're excluding from the analysis for present purposes the mandatory rules, cases in which a Congress or court is demanding that an agency do take particular action. Where there is discretion, the basic premise here is that, you know, the president can sort of exercise discretion holistically and set policies and set a certain regulatory agenda for each of the executive agencies and departments. So if you look at our brief, we sort of trace the evolution of this notion of centralized executive control over the administrative state from Roosevelt through the creation of the executive office of the president to essentially the creation of the Office of Management and Budget, and especially the creation of OIRA within OMB as a sort of centralized group within the White House responsible for reviewing significant regulatory actions and for reviewing the regulatory impact that particular rules will have on the economy, the impact that particular rules will have on the states. And if you take a look at the executive orders that presidents from at least Gerald Ford to the present have issued, they all on some level are instructing agencies, cross-agency, to take costs into account and to take other factors such as the effect on state and local governments into account. And this is all in furtherance of this notion of a centralized rule of review of rulemaking within the executive branch. And there were two orders in particular that we thought were important or similar in kind and type to the one in, two out order, and were helpful in terms of demonstrating why this is in kind really nothing new. And the first was one that was enacted by issued by President Clinton, in which he directed the agencies to eliminate 50% of their internal civilian management regulations within 3 years. I mean, this to me has the same sort of bright line rule problem that the plaintiffs are complaining about in their one in, two out order. I mean, you know, if you can't have a rule like that, I mean, you could ask the same questions. Where does 50% come from? Where does 3 years come from? It's sort of the same. It's sort of this rule of thumb that furthers a cost-cutting objective, and it's a very bright line. And then we also highlighted executive orders from President Obama, who did not have sort of a bright line rule, but nevertheless did have a direction to agencies to review and repeal those rules that were, quote, outmoded, insufficient, ineffective, or excessively burdensome. So this also bears similarity to the one in, two out order, even though it's not sort of a bright line rule. It is a standard, and it is a direction from the president to the agencies to engage in this sort of holistic review of regulatory burdens. And it's always helpful when you can cite Cass Sunstein, for example, in support of your proposition, as he is the head of was the head of President Obama's OMB, and he wrote an op-ed that was actually somewhat supportive of the rule. It wasn't sort of full-throatedly supportive, but he did say, you know, it while some people have described the one in, two out concept as a little bit gimmicky, that it was essentially a reasonable way to pause after the regulatory growth of the Obama years and to sort of take stock at where we've come and where we're going. And even though some people have criticized one in, two out as a rule, it really, you know, finds its justification in administrative convenience, for one thing. I mean, when you're considering such a vast bureaucracy, I mean, it's hard, I think, to effectively implement a sort of mushy standard like you have in the President Obama executive order. What does outmoded mean or inefficient mean? If you institute a policy that applies across the board, it's certainly easier to administer, and it's directional, right? I mean, it certainly sets forth and implements a deregulatory policy. So. Predictions with respect to this particular lawsuit, always hard to know, and we do have an Obama appointee as the judge, but it's possible that it could be resolved at the motions to dismiss phase. I do think there's a very strong argument that a facial challenge to this should fail, that there are, at minimum, some constitutional applications of the order. And of course, as we argue, we think it's constitutional, period. But, you know, we do think it's quite possible this gets thrown out on ripeness grounds. The plaintiffs have already filed a summary judgment motion, but it's likely that we'll see the Department of Justice try to stay that pending review of their motion to dismiss. But if the case does proceed, we will certainly, as the states, continue to stay involved. And, you know, we'll also look for opportunities to get involved if we see this case and the challenge come up again in an as-applied context, which I think is the much more likely way in which the rubber is going to hit the road and that you're going to see a court really grapple with the legality of this order. So Dean, that's what I had by way of preliminary remarks. So I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you so much. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on our telephone. A reminder while we wait to see who rings in, to check your calendar, or check our website, rather, and check your emails for announcement of teleform calls that might be taking place on Monday or Tuesday in response to decisions being made by the court. Of course, if you have a question today, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I'll get us started here as we wait to see if anybody rings in, Tom. Is there something, maybe you can help me understand, there's something magical or special about a written executive order? It certainly, it has the benefits of providing some clarity to the extent that it's written down and there's a record of it. It provides transparency in the sense that it's a publicly available document. But I can't imagine that a president couldn't have a meeting of his cabinet privately and instruct every cabinet member, either one-on-one or all together, that for every regulation you put forward, you have to get rid of two regulations. That's the policy of this administration. Go forth. And if he can do that, maybe he can't, but if he can do that in a private session as a direction to his agency heads, why can't he do it in a written order? Is that part of this case?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it, Dean. And obviously, you know, we're seeing sort of a very interesting group of lawsuits springing up all over the country about exactly what a number of President Trump's executive orders mean. And we're seeing this right now in the Sanctuary Cities case out in California, and in connection with the recent religious liberties exemption executive order that is being challenged, was just recently promulgated and challenged. There is this question as to whether what these executive orders are doing is actually setting forth binding rules on the agencies, or whether they're more just sort of statements of policy or sort of use of the bully pulpit. And whether they're really necessary or legally binding at all, and I think it definitely depends on the actual executive order in question. Certainly, I think we saw a lot of abuse of the executive order process under President Obama. I think that in this case, the executive order is in fact appropriate for the reasons that I described. I mean, it's very much in a long line of traditions of executive orders relating to executive centralized control of the regulatory state. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I'm sure that the president can communicate these sorts of commands informally, and I think it's all part of his it's really mostly a political check, because I think all of the executive heads understand they're ultimately responsible to and serve at the pleasure of the president. But I do think there is something in having a formal direction to all of the agencies and a formal process that you can carry out throughout the government. And I also don't think that we should minimize the sort of bully pulpit aspect of this order or others, seeing as I think it is important, particularly given the president's campaign promises on regulatory reform and in other areas, that the people who voted for him see that he is actually committed to carrying these policies out. And I think that essentially there's, you know, a new sheriff in town and a new sort of regulatory direction for the federal government. And I think this order accomplishes that.
Yeah, I see that. And once again, to our audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your phone. Our lines are wide open. I guess what I was suggesting is whether or not the folks who filed the lawsuit here, do they have to allege as part of their case that the president just doesn't have this power? That if he doesn't have the power to write this down as an executive order, he also does not have the power to individually or as a group instruct his agency heads that they're to, for every regulation they promulgate, they're to get rid of two.
That makes complete sense. And I think they would certainly say that with respect to doing that at the group level, that would be impermissible, whether formal or informal, because it's sort of, I read their complaint as at root challenging the entire notion of sort of cross-agency review of rules. I think for any of their claims to make sense, what they are saying at root is that you can't make trade-offs as between different statutory regimes, and you can't consider factors that aren't clear on the face of the statute. And we know that that can't be completely right, because there are a lot of cases, and certainly in the environmental context in recent years, in which the Supreme Court has said that consideration of cost in particular is sort of has become a principle of reasoned rulemaking. I think it's a decision by Justice Scalia that used that formulation. And so even when a statute does not specifically or explicitly provide for cost-benefit analysis, it's inherently irrational for an agency not to take into account whether the purported benefits of a rule are outweighing its cost. So really the only further question that this executive order in this case presents is whether the president can perform this task holistically, as opposed to, as you suggested, Dean, maybe only reaching out one-on-one to particular agency heads with respect to particular statutory regimes. And I think there's strong support for the holistic approach from the behavior of presidents starting from Roosevelt to the present, as well as just the theory of the unitary executive.
Right. Very good. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We do have one question pending, so let's take our first call.
Hi, this is Daniel Shapiro. I'm a third-year law student at Antonin Scalia Law School. I was just wondering if you thought that this really was, it seems like you are insinuating that it really is just an attempt to demean executive directive authority over the administrative state as a whole. And it seems that there might be some, you know, a connection to what the court did in Massachusetts versus EPA, where it does mm-hmm. attempt to unmoor the presidential directive authority from the administrative state itself. So I guess my question is, where exactly would this directive authority be located? Would it be the executive vesting clause, or do you take a more holistic approach to Article 2? Locating it in like a combination of the take care clause and the written opinions clause?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, of course, this is always tricky because unlike the enumerated powers that you have with respect to Congress in Article 1, there's all this literature about what exactly does it mean to have, to sort of vest the executive power in a single person. And obviously those vesting clauses are written very differently, where it seems as if it's not just sort of a number of delegated legislative powers that Congress can enjoy, but it's sort of the entire concept of executive power on the federal level is vested in the chief executive. So I think that I would locate that in sort of the concept of executive power as well as the vesting clause. I think it's then as sort of set forth by the Supreme Court, and I think it's Myers v. United States, is just the concept of being able to remove the agency heads at will. I mean, I think that is essentially a power whose purpose is to ensure that you don't have sort of a balkanized executive. I mean, what you have is an executive that's ultimately accountable to the president. And of course, you know, that's tested in any number of ways through the concept of independent agencies to what we're seeing in the news today with respect to the roles of the FBI and the roles of special counsels and things and the like. And these are sort of part of ongoing debates. But I think that at least with respect to the notion of centralized regulatory control for executive agencies and departments directly responsible to the president, I think that there's a fairly unbroken tradition. And that's sort of what our brief tries to communicate.
Once again, if you
Thank
have a
you.
Question, yep, you're welcome. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open once again. While we wait to see if somebody else rings in, let me ask you a question. You might have addressed this in your remarks in chief, and if you did, I apologize. I was a bit distracted by some business here in my office, but how is this executive order going to interact with a regulatory budget type executive order that caps the costs overall? Has there been any discussion of that, or is that part of this case at all?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I have not seen that as part of this case. I suppose what may happen is that the OMB will take those budget caps into account in terms of setting sort of the incremental cost targets for each agency for fiscal years 2018 and beyond, which this executive order does require the OMB to do. And so you'd like to think that there will be some sort of centralized oversight of the executive budget in that regard. But no, I mean, it's not entirely clear how it plays out, Dean, in that regard. And I think there are a number of unanswered questions here that only time will tell. I mean, another one that occurred to me as I was preparing for this is that, I mean, really on the face of the executive order, all that it requires is that an agency identify two potential rules for repeal for each new rule that's proposed. There's no obvious mechanism for actually ensuring that that happens. The guidance says, well, ideally agencies should, do these repeals close in time so that you're actually promulgating the new rule and noticing the repeal of the two rules at the same time. And of course, there is this requirement that annually you sort of submit accounting with an approximation of cost savings and new costs imposed. And so, we'll have to see. I mean, we'll have to see how well the agencies actually comply with it. And, there was a lot of this, I think a lot of disappointment. Maybe people expected it, but, President Obama in promulgating a similar regulatory reform order at the start of his presidency required sort of periodic reports from the agencies on compliance. And I think what you largely saw how that played out, it was the compliance that was sort of token compliance. I mean, they would champion the repeal of certain, very limited rules with, and sometimes they'd be on topics that, it would be so laughably outdated, you'd sort of agree, oh, well, of course, this rule should be repealed. But meanwhile, they're enacting, huge regulatory programs, Obamacare being a notable example, which dwarfs in terms of regulatory costs and complexity anything that was being repealed. So it goes back to what you said, Dean. I mean, these things do look great on paper as sort of the onset of a presidency, and time will tell through the implementation how well these actually work in practice.
Very good. Once again, our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button and a pound button on your telephone. I'll ask another question while we wait to see if somebody else rings in. And that is, you mentioned sort of an arbitrary and capricious standard, or we're testing sort of the limits of presidential authority here. Could a president sign an executive order, for example, or otherwise direct agencies, I have determined that regulations are good, universally so, or at least on the whole, the more regulations, the better. Every one of you must promulgate 10 regulations a year or 20 regulations a year. Is that within the president's authority to mandate something like that or direct something like that?
Well, I think, I think I'd probably make the same case that it would be premature to, potentially premature to evaluate the validity of something like that on its face. Mm-hmm. The way that you've described it, though, it would seem like it would be challenging to apply that in a way that was consistent with those principles of reasoned rulemaking that I'm talking about. It's not what makes this, I think, a workable rule is not so much that it's just saying generally less regulation or more regulation, but that it requires sort of a sensitive balancing of benefits and costs and sort of a holistic look at that. So I think if what you're saying is just more regulation, at some point I suspect that would bounce up against some pretty significant limitations that are intentionally sort of baked into the APA. I mean, really the APA was designed to limit the power of federal agencies, right? I mean, it was designed to get around, and we can argue whether it successfully did that or not as a matter of initial constitutional interpretation, but sort of was intended to address the delegation problem that you otherwise would have from Congress giving all of this regulatory authority to the agencies as well. Hold on a minute, you need to make sure that what you do is not arbitrary and capricious, that it's otherwise consistent with law, that your factual findings are not clearly erroneous and the like. And so there is, I would argue, sort of an inherently, if not deregulatory bent to what the APA was designed to do, at least sort of a bent that requires sort of a critical eye that when when an agency enacts a new regulation. And I think, sort of from my perspective, thankfully in the courts, especially with the ascendance of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, I mean, we're starting to see some judges and justices take really seriously the APA's instruction that courts look at these rules and determine, are they in fact consistent with law? In other words, consistent with federal statutes. And so we might see some more teeth being applied to APA review in the near future.
Very good. I'm going to make a final call for questions. If you have a question, now's the time. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We do have one question, so let's go to our next caller.
Hello, my name is Jeff Johnson. I'm a practitioner in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for coming on and giving your view of the case. I had sort of a more basic question. I know you touched on it very briefly at the beginning, but what is the actual interest of the state of West Virginia in this particular case? It seems like this is more a matter of, you know, federal law between separations of powers, between Article 1 and Article 2, matters of the APA. It seems that without like a specific application of this order to a federal rule that affects, you know, interests within West Virginia, that I don't know, I just don't see exactly what the interests of the amici are here.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, thank you for that question. It sort of raises a, you know, I guess to answer that, I'll sort of take a step back and talk a little bit about, you know, my own office and sort of the evolution of these state solicitors, general offices and state attorney general's offices. I think, you know, as the national government has accumulated more and more power, and as it continues to enact policies of national scope and that is sort of in derogation of some of the powers that used to be reserved to the states, I mean, what you've seen, at least what you saw during the Obama years and what you're starting to see now on the other side with respect to Democratic AGs as President Trump has taken power is sort of a renewed sense of federalism and sort of a renewed interest in multi-state challenges to a number of different presidential directives or on the other hand, sort of multi-state support for presidential directives. And I think this follows in part from the fact of how, you know, the practice of a number of federal district courts, and we saw it for certain rules during the Obama years, and now again in the first few months of the Trump presidency, of issuing nationwide injunctions of various national policies that have effects on the states. And so, you know, to some extent, you know, all politics is local. To some extent, it's national, and more so. And so, you know, the states are actively looking for opportunities to get involved where they think that there is a specific interest in either ensuring the legality of a national policy or challenging it. And really, I mean, this, someone mentioned earlier in the call, Massachusetts, the EPA. I mean, that was one of the very first of these, and that was sort of a challenge by a number of Democratic AGs to attempt to compel the EPA to regulate greenhouse gases and make endangerment findings with respect to certain greenhouse gases. And so this has been sort of a phenomenon of the past 15 to 20 years. And in particular, with respect to this specific executive order, you know, I mean, I can only speak for West Virginia, and I imagine other states had a similar experience. You know, West Virginia was very hard hit, for example, by the Clean Power Plan that President Obama and the Obama era EPA enacted, you know, that rule, if it were found lawful, would require states to put certain plans into effect that would essentially, and we made this argument in court, essentially commandeer the state governments, but at least, you know, require them to essentially come up with plans that would implement this energy trading regime that the Obama EPA put forth in the Clean Power Plan. And so, I mean, the concern here or the thought is that better cost management of regulations at the federal level, more attention to the trade-offs of costs and benefits at the federal level will ultimately inure to the benefits of the states because it will force federal agencies to put the brakes on, force them to carefully consider their actions before imposing these sorts of burdensome regulations. And one thing we do note in the brief, and I think I touched on it briefly, is at least two prior executive orders. I think one of them was a President Clinton executive order, explicitly instructs federal agencies to consider the effect on state and local governments. And that is just another example of sort of a holistic approach to rulemaking that presidents have adopted in this context.
I guess I will make another final call for questions since we got a question in response to the other. That is, if you have a question, now's the time. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I believe, Tom Johnson, we have had our final question. We've got a couple minutes left. Let me give you a chance to express any final thoughts and maybe talk about the road ahead, if you could.
Sure. Happy to do that. Well, I think, you know, thanks everyone for listening. I mean, I think, you know, the road ahead on this is just to sort of be vigilant, at least with respect to this particular litigation, see how it plays out and continue. I mean, part of my job and part of the job that part of the fun part of this job is that, you know, we're always sort of on the lookout for new opportunities to be involved where it makes sense for the states. And so you have to monitor litigation. And so where the rubber's going to hit the road here is when agencies actually start implementing this order, and you'll probably see specific challenges to particular applications of it. I mean, another great example recently is, you know, Congress is finally starting to make use of the Congressional Review Act. And so all of a sudden on the Democratic side, you're seeing challenges to the constitutionality of the Congressional Review Act, raising separation of powers challenges to that. And so this is just one other example of it. I think there's going to be a lot of very interesting litigation concerning the federal regulatory state that's going to come up in the next few years, and we'll be watching it. And, you know, I'd like to make, one final pitch, if it's okay, Dean, because, you know, I know that there were some law students on the phone today. And, you know, if anyone on the phone is interested in state SG work, I mean, we are currently hiring, and we're always sort of looking for new talent. And, you know, you do get to do a lot of interesting stuff, like participating in this high-profile litigation and considering a lot of these very interesting constitutional issues. And so, you know, if you have any interest in that at all, please feel free to reach out to me. I'll give you my email address is tjohnson@wvago.gov. That's tjohnson@wvago.gov. And I look forward to hearing from you. And, Dean, I thank you again for this opportunity.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society and my own behalf, I thank you, Tom Johnson, for outlining this for us. It's very interesting information. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to the audience to check the Federal Society's website for breaking news and opinion teleform conference calls early next week. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.